Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter News. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests, so you can develop your own, more informed opinion. My guest today is Amber McReynolds, CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute, co-author of the book When Women Vote, and one of our nation's leading experts on election policy and administration. Ms. McReynolds is also the former director of elections for Denver, Colorado, where she transformed the elections division into a national and international award-winning office. She's proven that designing pro-voter policies, voter-centric processes, and implementing technical innovations can improve representation for all voters. And with the confusion and controversy surrounding this year's mail-in voting, she's the most experienced professional I know to help us understand that issue. Welcome to Deconstructed, Amber.
It's great to be here.
Amber, how did you first become involved in the world of election reform?
It actually dates back even to my undergrad, and I went to the University of Illinois and then studied abroad, and in that experience decided to actually go and do my master's after my undergrad over in London. So I lived there for 2 years and worked for a member of parliament, actually, who was the Solicitor General at the time for the United Kingdom, and got a wealth of knowledge in the policy arena, research area, and then coupled that with my master's of science degree in comparative politics at the time, which really introduced me and educated me quite substantially on the entire ecosystem within the world and comparative politics and democracies and that kind of thing. And then I moved back to the United States, and one of the first jobs I had after my graduate work was for the New Voters Project, which was a nonpartisan civic engagement group that was in various states around the country with a focus on civic engagement and improving access for information for new and younger voters on college campuses. So I was one of the state coordinators in Iowa and worked during the 2004 election for that initiative. And then after that, applied for an operational coordinator job in Denver and started in as a coordinator. I moved to a management role and then was promoted to deputy director right around 2007-2008 timeframe, and then became director of elections down the road in 2011. But when I started in Denver, it was actually really difficult. It was a hard place to work in for the first year. No one on staff really liked each other very much, and there was not a customer-focused or a voters-first kind of mentality. It was sort of the mentality of, this is the way we've always done it, and so this is the way that we'll keep doing it, instead of a real focus on customer service and how to improve the customer and the voting experience for all. So because I was a staff level, I mean, my ideas weren't really taken up the chain. And so I started a journal, actually, where I just would write down my ideas as I saw flaws in the process or technology flaws or customer service flaws. I would make note of those. And I kept a journal for, gosh, the first year and a half I was there, just sort of waiting for the opportunity to bring ideas forward or looking for a way to do that. But I wanted to at least document the ideas I had. And Denver had a bad election, actually, about a year and a half after me arriving there. And the only part of the process that worked pretty well was vote by mail, but yet we still had challenges too. And a lot of folks got fired because of the technical failures that happened in the field, and there was a leadership changeover and all of that. And the new clerk came into office, and I just respect her so much even today, and she's definitely been a mentor to me. But she sat down and said, I really want you to be a part of the solution here. What ideas do you have? And I pulled out that journal I had been keeping, and I said, I actually have a lot of ideas, and started describing some of the ideas I had. And I got promoted to be a manager, and then the rest is history. We really started to implement a lot of those ideas and moving the organization forward and redesigning things, and really all with a focus on how do we better serve the public and how do we make the voting experience awesome for every person that we interacted with.
Well, when you ultimately became director of elections, you won a number of national and international accolades. Can you just touch upon some of the major changes that you made?
So within the office, elections, it's a very complicated ecosystem, and it's driven by policy on the legislative side. So it's sort of, I always say that this is, it's kind of a weird thing that the players of the game, the ones running for office, are the ones that are responsible for setting the rules of the game, which is sort of an odd construct, but that's how it happens. And so there's always, you know, look across the country, there's a ton of flawed election policies. And frankly, it's because a lot of them are outdated or there hasn't been a political will to actually improve them. So I looked at things from Is this a policy problem? Is it a process problem? Or is it a technology problem? And to me, those are the three tenets of improving the election ecosystem, is to figure out which issue, which one of those pieces is causing the problem. And so the entire staff ended up getting trained on Lean Six Sigma principles. We had black belts throughout the agency trained on how to improve processes and eliminate waste. We also used that process to start identifying outdated policies and laws on the books that we could go and advocate for change. And then we also looked at, once we've eliminated the waste out of the process, would technology help improve it further and automate things further? And so we try to look at all three of those things all the time, and with the overall goal of being, how do we more effectively serve voters, move voters through the process more effectively, and improve their voting experience? Take down calls. We don't want to see complaints. You know, we really dug into the customer service data and tried to use that data to tell us how we were doing and how we were performing. And so we made a lot of procedural and process changes. We also enhanced technology. Denver was the pioneer of BallotTrace, which is a ballot tracking system. Just like tracking a package in the mail, you can track your ballot. Denver was the first jurisdiction in the country to create that. We also created an app called eSign that allowed for electronic circulation of petitions as opposed to the paper on the clipboards. And then we took it to the next level and advocated for policy changes based on what we identified as being problematic for voters. We would take those initiatives to the state legislature. And now, 7 years ago, actually back in 2013, I, along with a couple of other dedicated election officials and leaders at the local level, actually mostly women around the state of Colorado, worked together to design and redesign our voting model. And that's what we have in place now. It's been in place where we automatically register voters to vote. We have same-day registration. We have vote centers where you can vote at any of them in the jurisdiction. And every active voter gets a ballot in advance of every election. So that whole thing was really about, how do we improve the voting process for every single elector and tear down barriers? And that model passed. It's become a model that lots of states have been adopting or expanding. And that's really how we looked at things, from all three: policy, process, and technology. And we really accomplished everything in Denver. We improved things across the board.
Well, you did a tremendous job there. And now you're the CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute. Tell me what that institute's mission is.
So our mission at the National Vote at Home Institute is to improve the voting process for all eligible electors across the country. And our path of doing that is expanding vote at home options, because we believe that's a safe, secure, accessible, and convenient way for voters to vote. And so what we're focused on is improving the process within states, so the vote by mail or absentee voting process that might exist, with the goal of making sure that voters can continue to access safe and secure options to vote.
And is this a way of extending the reach of what you had accomplished in Denver?
Yes, absolutely. Every state is going to vary. Every state is responsible for setting policies and the rules of engagement, the rules of the game, if you will, for elections. But I think there's so many great lessons that came out of the Colorado experience that can easily be replicated in other states. And we can start to then see other states see historically high turnout and improved processes and more informed voters and a safer way to vote, especially in a pandemic. So that's certainly replicating some of those good things, understanding that there's not a cookie cutter approach necessarily, and every state is going to vary a little bit in what their needs are.
Well, Amber, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about voting at home when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Amber McReynolds, the former Director of Elections for Denver and now the CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute. Amber, we were just getting into the mission of the Institute. I think there may be some confusion between absentee voting and at-home voting. Would you please explain the difference?
Well, voting at home is really the broader scope, right? So there's really two methods to vote. You're either going to vote in person, that might be at a polling place, that could be at a vote center, that could be during early voting or on election day. That's kind of the group of in-person options. And then there's voting at home, and that can include absentee voting, where you're making a request, mail-in voting, as some states call it, vote by mail, as some states call it. And so all of those things fall under the umbrella of a voter being able to vote at home. But essentially, the ballot is, regardless of what the terminology used, the ballot is treated exactly the same when it comes back to the election official. So whether you are in a state like Colorado and you register to vote, and therefore when you register to vote, you're asking for your ballot, so we'll mail you the ballot each election, or if you're in a state that requires more bureaucracy and has you fill out a request each time, regardless, the process is fundamentally the same thing.
Could you explain the security steps that are taken? I think a lot of the concern in the general public revolves around the issue of security. How do we protect the integrity of the vote?
I'll just speak a minute to the entire process around elections. So, what's critical across the board, regardless of the method of voting, whether it be in person or voting by mail, is that we're able to detect and deter any interference or bad actors. And so that takes a lot of different formats, right? So there could be on the cyber side of things, protecting the electronic information that is kept on file for voters in the voter registration database. That also means isolating the voting system and the tabulation aspect of the election so that it's not on the internet or exposed to the outside world, and making sure it's an isolated network. That also can mean physical security. So we have to protect our elections infrastructure. It's now critical infrastructure. The offices, all of the physical aspects of the election have to also be protected. And then also the security of the process. And so that in-person voting, there's specific protocols that have to happen to make sure that process is secure. And the same with vote by mail. And I actually, after running elections as long as I did, I actually ran lots of different models of elections. And I actually believe that the model that Colorado has now actually improved and enhanced security for a variety of reasons. But we built in a lot of different steps and processes, and there's naturally built-in security parameters within every vote-by-mail program around the country. And there's a lot of things about that process that a lot of people don't understand. Even when we're printing ballots, there's a specific paper weight that's used, and that varies by jurisdiction. It varies by the voting system that's being utilized. Envelopes are designed in a specific way for each election. The information that gets even sprayed or printed on the labels that you receive in the mail is specific to you as a voter, and then also specific to the election. So the idea that someone could sort of go and replicate and infiltrate all of that is actually pretty outlandish, given all of the different steps that have to happen to make that process actually come to fruition. And then in addition to that, we also created Ballot Trace, as I mentioned earlier, and that is a system that's just like tracking a package. It gives the voter visibility either via text or email as to the status of their ballot. So once it's been mailed, you can track it through the postal system with an intelligent mail barcode. You can also get a confirmation when the election official has received it back. So that kind of accountability built in ensures that the voter knows where that ballot is, and election officials actually have visibility, and they can hold the post office accountable if there's any delays on the delivery of ballots. So that's exactly the type of system and process that we want to see so that we can deter and detect bad actors. And then one of the other things that's come up a lot in the news in the last week is about ballot drop boxes. So these are 24/7, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're monitored by cameras. They're giant, in some cases, 600-pound steel containers that are bolted into the concrete. They're actually more secure than even the blue mailboxes. They're actually a lot more secure than blue mailboxes. But they're designed for voters to, if they decide they don't want to mail their ballot back and take extra days in getting it back to the election official, they actually can drop off at that official location, and then the election official empties that out daily. It's a bipartisan team that empties that box and then completes chain of custody logs to transfer those ballots in. So there's a full process for that aspect of the election as well.
And Amber, in Denver, when you instituted the quote unquote mail-in approach, well, isn't it true that about 70% of the people chose to hand deliver their ballots?
Over 70% on average each election drop off their ballot in person to either one of those secure boxes or to a drive-up drop-off where that's manned by election judges. But we tend to see that, and I think people really like it because they wait until the last minute to turn their ballot in too, so they often don't have enough time to mail it back because they don't want to miss the deadline, of course. So that's another benefit to the secure boxes, is that people can wait closer to election day as well, which we see a lot actually with people in submitting their ballots.
I've been fascinated by the media frenzy over the traditional blue mailbox, because when you do look at the history, the disproportionate number of people tend to return them directly. And in the 4 years prior to the 2016 election, I think there were 12,000 mailboxes taken out of service. So the mailbox isn't really the determinant of impact. You've created a system that has a chain of custody that gives you a variety of ways of voting, including the traditional way. You didn't do away with the traditional method of voting in Denver, did you?
No, and we actually just made it more convenient. So the traditional way is that the government assigns you to a polling place, usually in your neighborhood. And the problem with that is that so many people work often a long ways away from their home that we saw people not being able to make it home in time or near their polling place to make it to before the polls closed, or the polling place not being open early enough before they had to start their morning commute. So traditional assigned government location on one day actually disenfranchises a lot of people, especially those that work farther away from their homes. And so we created a vote center model where you're not confined to that one location. Instead of one location, you have 40 options as an individual. And so that makes it way more convenient. It might be near your kid's school or near work or near the grocery store, but you have multiple options instead of the one assigned government location on one day.
So you had a serious improvement in accessibility and as far as being able to deliver equitable elections.
Absolutely. And that type of model also, when you look at the more metropolitan areas of the country, for instance, we tend to see a higher mobility rate, usually at least 10%, meaning there's more movement within the community during the month. So what we were also seeing was those traditional polling places, a lot of people would show up to the wrong one because they had moved and not updated their address, or they missed the deadline to do so. And then they end up voting a provisional, which lengthens the lines, takes longer to process, and creates administrative hurdles in the process. So we were able to reduce provisional ballots by 98% in Colorado because we designed a more convenient, more accessible in-person voting option.
Well, that's outstanding. And beyond that, with the at-home approach, relative to the pandemic, I would suspect that this would be a safer alternative, or at least one that addresses concerns of people, even though we do have an expert like Dr. Fauci came out the other day and said he saw no reason why people couldn't vote in person if they followed an appropriate protocol. But this certainly eliminates that concern, doesn't it?
Well, it does, because the reality is people that are more vulnerable than others with regards to the pandemic. And, you know, people shouldn't have to risk their lives to vote and participate. And this gives voters a safe option at home where they don't have to stand in a crowded location if they choose not to. And I've been saying that Colorado and the states that offered this type of model were actually part of a minority of states that didn't have to make significant adjustments to their primary, either the date or the model at the last minute, because they had a resilient system that could withstand the impact of a pandemic.
Amber, we're going to take a quick break and talk about some of the potential challenges associated with voting at home when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Amber McReynolds, CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute and the incredibly successful former director of elections for Denver, Colorado. Amber, there are some perceived downsides to mail-in voting. MIT did a recent study in which you were actually cited for your good work in Denver, talked about 22% of all mail-in ballots don't get counted. And some of the reasons behind that, about 1 in 10 never get the ballot that they've requested, and about 1 in 10 ballots are ultimately disqualified because of date or signature issues or postage due and so forth. How can we address those types of challenges? Because those numbers are staggering as the mail-in vote grows.
Well, there's a couple of policy-related issues that have come up, frankly, in multiple states this year. First and foremost, I mean, with the adequate postage piece, one kind of obvious no-brainer type policy changes that there's a few of us have been advocating for and pointing out for a long period of time is essentially paying for postage nationally so that it's consistent by state. And we already actually do that for military and overseas voters. So right now, there's a federal indicia that's put on all of the military and overseas ballots that go out in every single state. That bill is paid for by the federal government. And so we have literally a system set up, a process, if you will, that could be extended to domestic voters. And so a lot of us have said for a long time, it'd be an obvious consistency across states. And so paying for postage definitely eliminates a barrier there. And there's also ways that we can automate that process even more effectively through the Postal Service. The Postal Service right now, they have to deal with all of the local election offices to process the postage paid account, get all of that administrative work set up. And there's over 10,000 local election offices that run elections. So that means the post office has to deal with 10,000 different local entities for setting up postage accounts and processing that information. If it was just one federal indicia, it would be one bill that the federal government would deal with. And it would certainly streamline things at the post office. The other piece is that the laws vary by state in terms of whether or not postmark is accepted or not. And so a lot of times we'll see ballots that come in late. So in one state, you know, someone might be able to mail their ballot by election day and it'll be accepted. In another state, it has to be received by the election official. And so some of those inconsistencies by state, when you've got a national media and you've got national campaigns that are communicating things out, can be challenging because voters hear different things about the process. So that inconsistency is somewhat of a flaw in that it creates problems for voters in understanding what they're supposed to do. The one way to solve some of those late ballot type issues is clear communication to voters. Make sure voters understand that the ballot has to be received, not just postmarked in a lot of states, and then offer ways for them to submit their ballot on time, like expanded drop boxes that aren't just postal receptacles, but actually secured drop boxes that go right to the election official. Because if the election official is managing it, they're going to be the ones emptying that right when the polls close, and therefore those ballots will get counted. If it gets dropped in a blue postal box, that requires a postmark and it requires extra time and days to get to the election official. And then one of the other big areas of concern that gets talked about a lot with mail ballots is signature verification. So the signature is compared to the signature of record. So that could be from a voter registration form or another document that the voters have provided. But there's a process and there's a validation that happens on that. And so what we want to look at is that percentage and see if when you compare it to the baseline, so if you look at a state like Colorado or Washington or Oregon, where there's been a lot of this, you kind of look to those states for a baseline. And then if you see a huge percentage that is much higher than what we would normally see, or even inconsistencies across counties within a state, that might mean that they have got some consistency problems with how they're applying the laws or the rules or the regulations around that topic. So I, for one, for example, am a big fan of using software. So there's signature validation software that a lot of jurisdictions are using now. And to me, that makes it actually more consistent because it's just an A to B comparison within a certain threshold to match. The machinery can't match, then a bipartisan team looks at it. So that tiered approach to signature verification really matters. And then also offering voters the chance to cure. So if a signature doesn't match, having a streamlined process for them to take care of that is absolutely critical in ensuring that every vote that's cast is counted and every voice gets heard appropriately.
Now, there's also been a lot of talk over the past few years about tampering by a foreign government, Russia in particular. I think you've addressed that, how difficult it would be because of the complexity of the ballots and the difference in local rules, paper types, inks, and so forth. How about tampering by the parties? Ballot harvesting presents a unique issue. I live in California. Orange County was once seen as a Republican stronghold, and every House seat went to a Democrat after an unprecedented 250,000 vote-by-mail drop-offs were counted. And the registrar for Orange County came out and said people were carrying in stacks of 100 to 200 ballots, and they had multiple people calling to ask if these people were allowed to do that. So how do you address that issue of ballot harvesting, which has been, frankly, one of the ways both parties have an opportunity to potentially tamper?
Well, so first off, the way I always look at these things is if we empower voters with individual options, so whether that be paying for postage or expanding drop-off options so voters can do it themselves, that takes down the likelihood of something like that happening, right? So the more options and more customer service, more good service that we put out, the better it is for voters to act on their own. States also vary on this front. So Colorado, for instance, limits the number to 10. So you as an individual can help your families and friends by dropping off, but you can't go above that. New Jersey's is 3. Other states, you can't drop off any besides the individual. So again, this is something that varies by state. I mean, we want to make sure people can turn in their ballots, that they have access, and we certainly know that the political parties are often out trying to turn out their voters and help their voters vote and all of that. But what we want to do is to be able to deter and detect any bad actors that are trying to do something they shouldn't be doing, like what we saw in North Carolina in 2018, where operatives were picking up voters' ballots and literally discarding them and disposing of them. And if we think about that, and North Carolina is a great case, the only place you could drop off your ballot was at the clerk's office. So if that was a 45-minute drive for you, then that was going to be a burden. But if they would have had more drop boxes, for instance, or if they would have paid pre-postage and had ballot tracking, those voters would have known immediately that something went awry with their ballot, and they would have had the accountability in place to figure that out. They also would have had more options to drop off their ballot or mail it back with prepaid postage. So that's a great example of how when you actually provide more access to individuals and empower individuals to vote and not rely on somebody else, it actually improves security. So that's a great example.
Got a real quick question for you before we wrap up. Early voting is a variant by state. How early is too early? I cast a vote, leveraging early voting. I pass away in the interim, my vote is counted. I'm registered in a state, I move between the date that I receive a ballot in that state, I don't take myself off the prior state's registration rolls, and I receive a ballot in the new state. So there's a potential for double voting. How do we address that? And what's early enough versus too early?
Well, so military and overseas voters, ballots start going out for them 45 days in advance. North Carolina is actually going to start sending ballots out to all voters on September 4th, full 60 days ahead of the election. In Colorado, what we decided, and we had the military and overseas ballots being mailed, and then when we were deciding on this policy, the political parties and campaigns really wanted there to be consistency statewide with when the counties would send ballots. So we made the choice to do it 25 days out. It started at 21, and then we pushed it back a few days to give a few more days in. But there's at least consistency at what the expectation is so that voters get the same information statewide. They know when ballots go into the mail stream and all of that happens. So it varies. I'm sure there's specific reasons in states as to why they would want more time. And I think about Alaska, for instance. The logistical challenges with voters in Alaska with the mail stream has their specific things in place. But even with postal service, there are parts of Alaska where voters, it takes them a day and a half to get from where they live into a city center or near a polling place. That might include dog sleds, right? So I think it's important that we're conscientious of the specifics within states while also providing access. I personally think it's a little early to be doing early September. It's certainly great for election officials to start the process and start moving through the process, but it seems a little early to me. But I think there's sort of this 45-day window for military voters. I would say 45 days and probably between that 25 and 45 is sort of a good place to land. I will tell you that there's a big process that happens to process ballots on the back end. So for election officials, the more time they have in advance of election day, the better off they are in terms of receiving ballots and getting everything ready for the big busy day, which is usually election day.
Excellent. Well, Amber, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about the National Vote at Home Institute and you, and maybe pick up a copy of your book, When Women Vote?
Sure. Well, the National Vote at Home Institute's website is voteathome.org. We also are on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And then my book is on Amazon, so it's called When Women Vote. We also have whenwomenvote.org, a little landing page that describes the book itself. And then we also have social media accounts for the book at When Women Vote. _ and then we're on Instagram as well. And then I have my own Twitter account at Amber McReynolds. And when I have time, I tend to share quite a bit about the election process, mainly good information, trusted information. I try to highlight a lot of election officials that are doing great work or states that are putting out good information. So it's a good account to follow as well, just for extra information around the election.
Well, Amber McReynolds, if our country had more politically engaged people like you, there'd be a lot less need for political talk show hosts like me. And a lot of people would probably say that would be a good thing. But you were a great guest, and I'm inspired by what the National Vote at Home Institute is trying to accomplish. We need greater access to casting our votes and a more secure and credible way for them to be gathered and counted. So, Amber, thanks for what you do, and thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you.